Happy Monday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hey, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Overcast, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere you can find podcasts. And obviously, we appreciate the fact that so many of you have been listening to us. Also, a quick reminder that if you have not yet subscribed to one of our Bulwark newsletters, there's still plenty of time before the end of the year. It's completely free. It's going to stay free. My Morning Shots comes out in the morning, as the name would imply. Jonathan Last has The Triad, which comes out midday, and Jim Swift's Overtime comes out later in the day. And so if you want the Bulwark injected directly into your inbox, there's really nothing stopping you from subscribing. We also have another podcast here on the Bulwark, which you should really check out. It is a Beg to Differ, hosted by Mona Charon with an all-star cast, and strongly urge you to check that out. Also, in today's Bulwark, there's a piece. Look, there's every day we have something that I might describe as a must-read, but today there's this extraordinary piece by A.B. Stoddard, Why is Mitch McConnell Afraid of This Man, with a picture of Lev Parnas, and really connects the dots about why Parnas and his Russian connections might be a ticking time bomb for Trump world, and linking it to Republican desire to rush through impeachment. And in that regard, I also have a companion piece suggesting that one of the final cards that House Democrats ought to consider playing is to impeach on Wednesday, but to withhold referral to the Senate until a majority of senators make it clear that they're in favor of a full and fair trial. We talked about that on Friday's podcast with former Congressman David Jolly. So our guest today, and I really appreciate coming into the studio today, is Donald Ayer, who was the Deputy Attorney General right before Bill Barr. Do I have that right, Donald?
You do, yeah, back in 1989 and 90.
So you were Deputy Attorney General, Principal Deputy Solicitor General, U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California. So you worked under Ronald Reagan and under George H.W. Bush.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about Bill Barr, who, right before we started this, I said, I continue to find Barr's behavior to be puzzling, and you said you are less puzzled.
Yeah. Well,
tell me about that.
Okay, sure. Let me start by saying I have known Bill Barr since something like 1978 or so, and the way I began to know him was, we both clerked for the same federal judge, Judge Malcolm Wilkie, just a wonderful man and great judge on the D.C. Circuit. I clerked 75, 76, and I forget when Bill was, but it was 1 or 2 years after me, I believe. But anyway, so I got to know him a little bit, and honestly, I've never really gotten to know him more than a little bit in all the years since. Through that sort of clerk network, you know, every year Judge Wilkie would have a clerk reunion, and we'd all get together and have dinner. And when Bill started clerking, he was there. So I knew him. I knew him from that. And I knew he'd worked for the CIA before and during law school. And I knew him to be someone, I don't know him very well because he's not someone who is loud and outspoken about things. And I don't know how many words I've exchanged with him in my lifetime, but it's probably not over 1,000. But I knew him to be someone who had kind of a closed mouth, I knew he had an orientation toward a strong executive, and I knew he thought the CIA was really important. But then over the years, you know, with great gaps when I wasn't knowing him or dealing with him at all, I became aware through his work at OLC of his orientation. Basically in favor of a strong executive, a few things that he did there, and just generally reputation within the government. So yeah, I think that's sort of the beginning of the explanation for I wasn't surprised, is that he's had this view for a very long time.
And yet he had this reputation as an institutionalist, right? He was the Attorney General under the first President Bush, and not tremendously controversial, although William Safire wrote pieces essentially, you know, suggesting that he was kind of, Attorney General cover-up. at the time. But I think that the general expectation was that this was one of the grown-ups. This was an establishment Bush-era Republican. He wasn't a Trumpist. I mean, it wasn't, you know, Jeanine Pirro as attorney general. And I think there was tremendous relief that at least he wasn't, you know, now I've forgotten. Who was the acting attorney general? Was it Whitaker? He was just so horrible.
Well, see, that's right. No, that is right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the thing, the place to look to not be surprised, and I didn't see it until after the fact, but of course I'd known Bill a long time too. But that memo that Bill Barr wrote in June of 2018 has flames coming off the edges. I mean, it is the damnedest thing I ever saw. And I think it's probably fair to characterize it as a tryout memo, essentially for attorney general. It was written to Rod Rosenstein, and I'm sure it was intended to make its way to the president and others. But the thrust of it is a vision of the presidency, which is got nothing in common with our traditional view of government of checks and balances. The power, the president has a lot of power. He has major power, especially in foreign policy. But he's checked and balanced up and down the line by the Congress and the courts and every different way that you can, you know, you can go through your civics book and talk about. And this memo by Bill Barr, making the point centrally that the Mueller investigation, I guess, as a whole, was an outrage, and essentially characterizing the president as the executive branch. He says in there literally, the president is the executive branch. He talks about how the idea that the president should be separated from the oversight of investigations in the Justice Department simply can't be. It's illogical within the framework that says the president is the executive branch. He specifically says in this memo that not only would it be entirely proper, but it is necessarily unavoidable that the president could oversee, must oversee an investigation even of himself. And that for the president to decide that an investigation for whatever reason, including the fact that he didn't like himself being investigated, was improper, would cause no problem. So, of course, with a view like that, how can somebody like Bob Mueller, as an independent check on the president, have a right to exist? And, you know, so to me, once you know that about Bill Barr, then so much of what's occurred, and there's so many things now that he's done that reflect this vision, how can any of that be surprising?
Yeah, no, I agree. In fact, just in my own mild defense, I did write back in April in the Bulwark, seven reasons not to trust Bill Barr. And then the next one, we should not have been surprised about Bill Barr. However, I guess the part that continues to puzzle me is his complete lack of concern for what this is going to do for his legacy or for his reputation. And obviously he's not unique in this, but also how deeply radical his position is. And I want to underline this because you were interviewed by the Washington Post last week after Barr came out and, you know, sharpened his attacks on the Russian probe. And you said he's bringing to bear in all of his conduct here a perspective on the law that the president is all powerful and should be able to do pretty much what he wants. And I think we're not done yet. It seems likely that Barr will do some pretty bad things with whatever facts Durham finds by viewing them through the lens of his twisted concept of executive power. So the part that where I sort of have the intake of breath is it's not just that he favors a strong executive, because lots of people favor a strong executive. The phrase that you used is this notion that the president is in fact all powerful. Right. How radical this idea of the unitary executive is, and what it does to our concept of the constitutional balance and checks and balances, which he appears prepared to completely shatter.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, and I so the one of the things I hear you asking is why would he want to ruin his reputation like that?
Well, let's start with that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and I guess I don't feel like I know the answer to that. I think a charitable view, which might be true, is that for reasons that are beyond my own comprehension, and I think that of many others, maybe he actually believes this stuff that he is asserting. Maybe he really thinks that we actually need an executive who has this kind of power. I won't speculate as to why he would really think that, that there you can come up with things. Maybe he thinks it's a tough world out there. And by God, if we don't have a president who's got, you know, clubs in every closet and can do anything he wants, we're in big, I don't know. I mean, I don't know
no,
what it would
that,
be.
No, that is
but
possible.
He may really believe that, and he may really think that he is a person of principle. The problem is that the principles that he is working so hard, working overtime by just numerous acts that he has committed and I think will commit, what he's seeking is a vision of America that is not the one any of us thought we had and have reveled in for all these decades that we've been alive. I don't personally subscribe to the view that Bill Barr is nothing but a toady for Donald Trump. I don't really think that's true. I think he's got a long line of conviction of strong executive. I do think, though, that so many of the things that he has done and continues to do are totally unprincipled and dishonest. If maybe in his mind the end justifies the means, but I don't think it's true if someone of reason and moderation sits down and looks through the list of things he's done, because it's just shocking.
It is shocking. So how does this play inside the Justice Department? Do you still have people there that you know? Do you get some sense of, you know, the Justice Department has career lawyers. It has traditions. It has norms. And to have a president and an attorney general who's prepared to blow up many of those traditions and ignore those norms, how does that play within the department itself?
Well, I don't have a whole lot of firsthand contacts there now, but I have no doubt whatsoever that it is enormously demoralizing. I worked there for a bunch of years, and there's just such a sense of pride. I remember the first time I stood up in court as an assistant U.S. attorney and said, you know, Donald Lehr on behalf of the United States of America, and it brings tears to your eyes, and it makes you proud, and it makes you focus on you're there to do the right thing. You're there to pursue justice. You're there, you know, essentially to not cheat anybody out of anything or lie to anybody. And what these people in the department now are seeing is an attorney general who is trashing many of the ideals that, you know, essentially have guided the department for many years. I think, you know, the worst one is, well, there's a whole lot of them, but the worst one is sort of shoving aside the tradition that the toughest things the department does in terms of investigations and criminal enforcement and stuff like that are completely separate from politics. They are totally set aside, and people traditionally, you know, up to and really including Attorney General Sessions, people have worked very hard to avoid the impression of impropriety. So even Jeff Sessions recused himself from this investigation and was, of course, pummeled by the president for doing so. You haven't heard Bill Barr recusing himself in anything, including the situation where his name was mentioned by the president in the context of the Ukraine thing. He's just right in there, you know, wading in with both feet and doing whatever he wants. And, you know, the scary part for me right now, just on what we can see, is, you know, after the IG report, which Barr totally distorted and twisted and mischaracterized, focusing only on the bad things that were found. And there were troubling things found. There's no doubt about it. But they were, in the way people went about doing things, they were distinctly not bias or impropriety in commencing the investigation, and they were distinctly not a bias or impropriety in the judgments that were ultimately made in the investigation. And that's really ultimately the biggest set of issues, and Barr sort of shoves all that aside and rejects it, really. Rejects, you know, specifically said, I don't agree. So he undermines and rejects the independent report of the IG on whether it was properly predicated, whether there was a basis for the investigation. So I think the people in the department have got to be pretty up in arms about all this.
Well, on the IG report, he rejects the top line findings, but he's clearly prepared to weaponize the other information within that report, the 17 instances in which they made mistakes in terms of the FISA application. And look, that's messy. I mean, there's some stuff there that is deeply troubling. And so what was your take on John Durham stepping forward and issuing that press release? Because I have to admit that was even more shocking to me than Bill Barr. I get, as I've sort of normalized, that Barr is going to run cover for the president, but the Durham thing was like, wow.
Well, I sort of see, I think it was totally wrong. And I sort of think of John Durham, and I am prepared to accept, I don't know John Durham, but I'm prepared to accept the statements about him, that he's a principled guy. He's got a reputation that's positive. He's been a dedicated public servant. I believe all that. I think the same thing was true of Rod Rosenstein. Mm-hmm. And you can talk about all Rod's efforts to A, appoint Mueller, B, protect Mueller, C, take the incoming from the president about him not being, all the attacks that he had to take personally. And yet at the end of the day, there is Rod Rosenstein standing behind Bill Barr when Bill Barr essentially totally mischaracterizes mm-hmm. the Mueller report with regard to obstruction. And one of the questions that I think arises about these people who are good people, I'm assuming, I don't really know either of them personally, but I'm not going to say anything wrong in the historical career of either one of them. Well, one of the problems we got going here is that the Attorney General, one thing that's true in the Department of Justice is you do a criminal investigation, you do any kind of an investigation, and facts are facts and you don't mess with facts. You got to protect the integrity of the Mueller investigation. You got to find the facts honestly. Mm-hmm. But law is a different thing. Law is subject to interpretation. One thing that goes on regularly in the department is formulation of legal positions that the department's going to take in the Supreme Court. And yeah, it has to follow the Supreme Court, except sometimes it can say, I think you really ought to reverse this decision. So the department is entitled to take positions on the law. And who gets to ultimately be the one? Well, in the Supreme Court, it's nearly always the Solicitor General, but he can always be overruled by mm-hmm. the Attorney General. And every now and then, not often, but maybe less than once a year, he may be overruled by the Attorney General. Well, the Attorney General can say, this is the understanding of a constitutional provision that we will be working with here. And my best, I'd say it's more than a guess, but my belief with regard to the Mueller report is that poor Rod Rosenstein, he talked about being able to land the plane. He wanted mm-hmm. to get this thing done. Well, he got it done in the sense that the facts were found. And of course, anyone who reads the Mueller report sees there's just overwhelming evidence of obstructive behavior. But Barr brought to the Mueller report a legal view, and the legal view essentially was, as he stated it pretty crystal clear in that memo, president really isn't capable of obstruction. He can interfere in his own election, investigation.
This is the part that is the, and maybe you can talk me down on the ledge here.
Okay. Probably not. Because, we'll
and maybe I'll get a little bit ahead of
I'm
myself
up there with
here.
You, unfortunately. But
my main concern now is, with the impeachment, which is the House is going to impeach him this Wednesday. And then they may send it over to the Senate. I'm hoping that they will withhold it until they get a fair trial. But Donald Trump's great plan right now is, and his expectation is that he will be acquitted by the Senate and that he will claim absolute exoneration. And at that point, he will not only be not abashed, he will feel he will feel vindicated. He will feel emboldened. He will feel empowered, and he will have Bill Barr at his back. What he is capable of doing post-acquittal really is alarming.
It is. It totally is. And you don't even have to speculate. Well, there's a lot of things you could speculate about. But one thing that is not really the subject of speculation is that you know, John Durham is doing this investigation, which is like the IG. And my first reaction when they started it was, what the hell's going on here? Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this? We got an IG report. Well, we don't really like IGs. They're kind of independent, and we want someone we can sort of lay a legal filter over and deal with. Plus, the Durham report goes beyond it to not just be about the Justice Department, but you got this criminal investigation that, you know, recent reports suggest or is going to come to fruition maybe sometime in the spring. And we're looking into things various people did, and it's going to get looked at. You know, Durham will find the facts. And just as with the Mueller report, Durham's facts are going to get viewed through the lens of Bill Barr's twisted vision of an all-powerful executive. So what is that going to mean in terms of the improprieties? You know, he made the point in his memo that Mueller had absolutely no business conducting this investigation. Well, what's he going to say about various things that people did? And he's already said from the IG report that really there was no basis to have any investigation of Trump and his campaign in connection with the Russian activities. God knows why that's true, except that the president's immune. So we're going to see in the spring, Barr, you know, his legal vision's going to guide the interpretation of those facts. And you can imagine, as the campaign gears up, that we're going to get this trashing of all the people who tried to, you know, hold the president and his various minions who were running around talking with Russians and everybody else. Even if you couldn't prove collusion, you absolutely knew that there were how many dozen but more than a dozen Trump affiliates who were talking to Russians. What the heck is that about?
Which we've never had a good explanation for.
No.
Okay, so I want to go back to this point you're making that Bill Barr essentially is arguing that it is impossible for the president to engage in obstruction of justice because he is justice, right?
Right.
And so it's impossible for him to even obstruct justice of an investigation into himself. Now, this is
and he literally said that. Literally.
This is breathtaking. So let's dial back for the moment to Watergate.
Okay.
And Richard Nixon's and Richard Nixon really went down because of the tapes that showed that he was trying to obstruct the investigation. So in Bill Barr's world or his mindset, if Richard Nixon would have just simply fired the FBI director and ordered the FBI to stop investigating him or any investigations involving him or his associates, would Barr's argument be that Nixon would have been within his power to do that?
I believe so.
Okay.
I think so. I think it follows from the fact that the president is the executive branch and can terminate an investigation into himself.
Okay.
Yes.
So now here's my talking off the ledge thing. So let's go forward to middle of January or late January. The president has been acquitted by the Senate. So the one big constitutional check on his power is gone. The next day, he orders the SDNY to drop its investigation of Rudy Giuliani.
Right.
What happens?
Well, I mean, one interesting...
he can do that, right?
Well, I think within that vision, yes. And I mean, of course, Bill Barr, as the head of the department, would need to be part of that. Any principled attorney general... Most any we've ever had that I know of would say, Mr. President, I'm sorry, we're not doing that, and I won't put up with it, and they would quit.
Which is what happened during the Saturday Night Massacre.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, one interesting little cultural thing about the Department of Justice and how it works and plays out, I don't know, but I'm not optimistic it would hold up. You know, the SDNY, the Southern District of New York, has long had, you know, way back before I was in the government, but it was certainly true then, there was this sense of the SDNY, that one district out of 92, autonomy is too strong a word, but they sort of went their own way. And there was sort of a sense of they are kind of the cream of the cream, and we just kind of let them do it because...
Kind of untouchable in that sense.
Kind of untouchable.
Yeah, yeah.
That's well put. And you know, is that really going to carry the water here to protect them? I'm not optimistic. They're breaking every different norm inside, and they ultimately are on the payroll. And if Bill Barr says, cut it out and has some BS way of explaining, you know, like he has repeatedly on various other things. They just do it and move on, and Trump tweets a few times, and there we are.
I mean, the one check would be mass resignations in, right. in protest.
And, that's right.
And you're, you know.
And I think you'd probably get some of that, and that's yeah. a good point, and maybe that's important. Maybe that would slow it down.
That is about the only thing that would do it, because, I mean, so going back to the day after acquittal, and I'm still on the ledge, by the way.
Yeah, by the way, so am I, yeah.
The president could announce, it is time to put an end to all of this, and therefore I am either ordering the end of all of these investigations or issuing blanket pardons to Rudy Giuliani, to right. Lev Parnas, yeah. to Paul Manafort,
right.
to Roger Stone.
Right.
And, of course, there would be horror, there would be outrage, it would last 48 hours, hair would be on fire. But again, in this view of the unitary executive and having the checks and balances in tatters,
right?
He could do that,
right? I mean, that's right.
It might hurt his reelection yeah, campaign.
That's but, right. I mean, one. I mean, I hate to say this, but you know, one of the things that I think a lot of Americans have taken far too much for granted is that in a democracy, we have this magnificent constitutional structure and all will be well. And I, as yes. a citizen, don't really have to be vigilant or even much care. And I think a piece of that, frankly, is the more general thing, which I'm on the ledge every morning when I think about this, when I wake up, that we have a president who lies all the time and misbehaves endlessly in every manner you can imagine, and we don't need to get into the details of that because we all know what it amounts to. And his supporters, the 40% or the 38% or whatever it is, do not care at all. And I think they think that our democracy is some sort of a magical self-perpetuating wonder that even if they act totally irresponsibly and don't care at all that the elected leader of the country is a complete evil person, that it'll all be fine. Well, guess what? It won't be fine. And the same thing's true of all these checks and balances. You know, the people have to care ultimately. And I think your point is well taken. If the public reacts to all this stuff that you're describing, which otherwise can happen in a negative way, and the president's election prospects are materially hurt, then a lot of this stuff probably won't happen.
That's a big if,
other than that, I don't know what stops it. So far, there's no sign of that I can see. Do you?
You put this extremely well, and this is, I think, is part of the rolling shock for a lot of Americans realizing that our system is much more fragile than we ever thought it would. You know, and there was a lot of happy talk in the first few years, like, well, you know, our institutions are resilient; they're able to push back, they're able to resist all of this. And now the big question is really. You know, if in fact those norms are not upheld by public opinion at this point,
right.
What does uphold them? And quite frankly, it is not clear that yeah. that the public would turn on him. So, for example, I was just thinking through if there were the mass resignations from SDNY in protest, a lot of the Trump base would go, yeah, good. You know, this is
sure.
He was elected to drain the swamp. These are the swamp creatures.
Absolutely.
This is the deep state. Therefore, they would see it as a positive.
Right.
And now I should say that we did have the Fox News poll yesterday showing 50% right. of Americans favoring impeachment.
Right.
Actually, 54%, 50% favoring impeachment and removal.
Right.
Which would suggest there's 4% in there that think you should be impeached but not removed, whatever. There's another USA Today poll showing it somewhat more divided. But, I mean, obviously, we're in a deeply divided country. And that's the moment where you think, okay, what are the essential values that a democracy and a constitutional republic need?
Right.
And those essential values seem to be really at risk right now.
I agree. I totally agree with you. You know, normally you would rely on the attorney general to be a bulwark, shall
right.
we say,
yes.
of those values, because he should be. And I'm afraid Bill Barr is, but has got other priorities. He should be a person who understands the critical sort of restraints that are inherent in a functioning democracy. And he ought to be vigilant And he ought to be ready to quit.
Okay,
if people are violating him.
Yeah, but
he's the perpetrator instead.
Yeah, I mean, he's Roy Cohn. He's happy with that. Okay, so the other bulwark, and I suppose the ultimate bulwark, would be the courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. And just last week, the Supreme Court decided it was going to take up the question of the president's claim of blanket immunity, specifically whether or not Congress should have access to his income tax returns. I think it's extraordinary by the way that the president would go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to keep his income tax return secret, which again is extraordinary in and of itself. On Earth 2.0, we'd be focusing on that. But do you read anything, or should we read anything, into the Supreme Court deciding to take up this question of presidential privilege and immunity, from having to give up this information? Was that
I think it's not surprising that where we are in this country is we have a huge national crisis, right? We got the president being impeached by the House, and part of that is a big fight about the fact that the president and his team have totally stonewalled the whole proceeding completely and basically denied any information or any witnesses. So that's an issue. You know, the D.C. Circuit opinion in the case about the tax returns had, the en banc opinion had two dissents from Trump appointees. It's not surprising, I don't think, that the Supreme Court would take up something of this national moment. Another question, though, is, which you didn't ask, and I don't have an answer to really, is how confident can one be that the court will do the right thing?
Well, that's where I was going.
I know. And I wish I could tell you that I'm totally confident that they will. If I had to flip a coin or lean one way or the other, I as an act of faith, I guess mostly, I would say, yeah, I think they'll probably do the right thing. There are four votes to do the right thing, I'm sure. And
this should be a 9-0 opinion.
Oh, of course it should.
I mean, and going back to Nixon, it was the Supreme Court's 9-0 decision saying he had to give up those tapes that really marked the end of it. And that's still a precedent, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that can make one hopeful. And I'm hopeful. I can't take it for granted.
Okay, here's another question that I had, and I was going back and forth before I landed on my, okay, go ahead with impeachment and withhold it. I had suggested that maybe the Democrats needed to slow down their process to be more aggressive in pushing for their subpoenas and demanding evidence. And the pushback I got, and I think this was in good faith. I got a text message from Congressman Liu from California, who said, "Look, if we did this, it would slow everything down by like 6 months. That it took that long to get the ruling in the McGahn trial, so we would basically be tied up in court, and so it would shut everything down." And the question that I had was, well, is there any possibility that, given the fact that we are in the midst of a constitutional, the constitutional provision of impeachment, that it is a formal proceeding, that the courts might expedite their decision on whether or not the president, as they did during Watergate, or is that also somewhat naive?
I think there is. What I heard today is that it is scheduled to be heard in March, which is not right away, but it's not that far down the road. But it's pretty far down the road when you think about 2020 being an election year and we got primaries that will have already occurred and all of that kind of stuff. On this topic of your point, I've had the same thoughts, and I also have related thoughts that come out of Jonathan Turley's testimony among those experts. And, he made a point which had some force with me, and that is, if you're going to impeach the president, should you build that on a narrow foundation of facts, not a strong, mm-hmm. not, 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 not facts that are weak, because these are not weak facts. These are just overwhelmingly clear facts. And the breach is far more serious, as far as I'm concerned, than any breach by any president who's ever been impeached before. Just a blatant use of his position for totally improper reasons. But it's a narrow foundation, and it's narrow especially when you put it alongside of the record here of all of the things that Donald Trump has done.
Yes.
My God, I mean, this is unbelievable. You can go on for days talking about breaches of duty and dishonest acts and probably criminality. I don't want to get into the specifics of that. You can go on forever, and do we really want to base an impeachment on this narrow, specific thing? Well, I've come out, I think, where, I don't know if you said you do, but where they did, and that is, look, you got to be practical. I mean, it's the problem that Donald Trump has presented everybody with in the media and everybody else is you can't up with his, you can't keep up with his misdeeds, because as soon as one is out of his mouth, there's another one behind it and another one and another one and another one, and you're left talking in circles around yourself, and nobody can understand what you're saying.
I agree with that. Yeah. To your point, I was asked the other day, how will history, look back on this? And I said, I think history is going to be amazed that he wasn't impeached for more stuff. History will be amazed of all the things that he got that, for which he was not impeached, all of the emoluments clause, all the corruption. Yeah. But I do think they have to make it narrow. But I did think that Turley's point about the thinness of the evidentiary file. Why not really push to get John Bolton's testimony? Why not fully and aggressively litigate the fact that the administration has turned over not one document other than that call readout? There is so much evidence out there, and it is completely within the constitutional prerogatives of the House of Representatives in an impeachment process to get this information. And the president's refusal to give up that information or to cooperate in any way is, and I know the term is overused, but if that's not a constitutional crisis, I don't know what is.
No, I agree with you. And I also, the idea that you mentioned earlier, which I first heard on your podcast the other day David Jolly. But the idea of impeach him and don't refer it and say, look, I mean, we're not going to hand this thing to a kangaroo court. We're not going to let you not have a trial, or, let's talk about the procedures. And, it might make sense to let it kind of hang in the air for a while and resolve some of these issues. And, the idea that John Bolton gets called at the trial, and the idea that McGahn gets called at the trial, and whoever the right people are. But that seems to me to be a pretty sensible thing to consider.
Yeah, and I think people are beginning to realize, and I wrote this in the Bulwark this morning, the moment that they turn it over to the Senate, the Democrats lose all leverage, and Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell can turn it into a show trial. But if, and I don't think it's a gimmick. I think that if Nancy Pelosi stands up and says, look, these comments by Mitch McConnell that he's going to coordinate with the White House, and by Lindsey Graham saying that that he's already made up his mind, these should be treated as game changers. These are people who are basically saying that they're going to treat this like a joke. We don't think it's a joke. And if she said, so we'll refer these articles of impeachment when a majority of its members commit to a full and fair trial that includes an honest attempt to look at the evidence, hear witnesses, and examine documents that have so far been withheld from Congress and the American people, that's a strong position to say. And it's also doable, because all you need would be three Republican senators to say to Mitch McConnell, no, you know what? When we pass the rules on this, we are not going to go along with all of this. And at that moment that you're assured that you are going to have an honest, fair, and open trial, then you refer it over. There might only be a week. But what Mitch McConnell, Senator Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins, they could form this constitutional caucus, as Bill Kristol calls it, and say, we may not vote necessarily to remove the President of the United States, but we are going to take our role as jurors actually seriously. This, I think, is capturing the high ground.
Makes sense to me. Yeah,
it does.
Sounds good.
Which means it won't happen.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's definitely worth considering for sure.
All right, Donald Lehrer, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on the Bulwark Podcast today. Appreciate it very much.
All right. Great. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.